Here.
John Kapler.
Here.
Betsy Pringle.
Yeah, you're on the show.
Elsie Weber.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. She's here.
And Rick Whitney.
Here. Let the record show that Elsie is here. She's making her way to the podium. So, for tonight, we have, after approving some minutes and council member reports and comments and a work program review, we will have a special presentation on the Puget Sound Energy Energize East Side, following by a hearing on the Cross Kirkland Corridor regulations and administrative reports. That's our agenda. Has anybody had a chance? I hope we've all had a chance to review the minutes. Let's start with the November 21st, 2013. That's an easy one. Any additions or corrections?
I have one. it says that I, John Kapler, was absent that meeting. I actually was there.
Yeah, there is an inconsistency because we have a motion that was voted on that carried 7-0, and yet they show that there are three members absent. So we have
I think we all got there late. But I know I was there.
I think we were all there. So could we? I guess we could make that correction. Any other additions or corrections? Would someone care to move for approval?
So moved.
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, so those minutes are approved with that correction. And then on the January 27th, 2014 meeting, any additions or corrections to that? Hearing none, would someone like to make a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Seconded.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor of approving the minutes of the January 27th, 2014 meeting, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Okay. Motion carries. So, do we have any council member reports or comments? John?
I have one.
Okay.
The City of Bellevue Planning Commission has had several meetings of which I've attended regarding neighborhoods within the city limits that are having quandaries over what to do with a hole in their zoning code. What is happening is people are buying single-family homes in single-family neighborhoods. They're using the Fair Housing Act regulations that stipulate houses can be comprised of up to six unrelated people, and essentially they're turning these into dorm rooms. And neighborhoods are becoming worried. City of Bellevue's investigation has found that this is actually a nationwide issue. We haven't heard about it within the City of Kirkland. Nancy is nodding her head. So the City of Bellevue is looking at a way to classify this as a particular zone or a zoning classification to figure out where it ought go to preserve the integrity of what a single family residential neighborhood ought be. I find it very interesting. I'm glad we haven't really heard about it here. I do think it is of importance to us, because one note that came from Bellevue is that they find this particularly rampant in areas where there are colleges, and what happens to be right in the middle of our jurisdiction is a college. So I think this is something that ought to be on our radar screen. With that report, I would like to ask Nancy if it's possible that if you research any complaints that we've had, because it's a complaint-driven issue, and possibly report back to us, and if this is maybe something that might be talked about on the planning side of things as to what the City of Kirkland wants to do with this or how they want to tackle it when it does show up, I'm confident it's going to show up. It's a very, very lucrative issue. You know, essentially when you have a home and you divide the rent by three people or four people, you know, guys or girls that want to live together and share rent. You divide it by the rent. These places are, you chop it into a number of rooms and everybody pays the same rent. You just cram more people in the house. Mm-hmm. And it's not like three or four people living in a house. It's groups of people living in a house that act independently. So it's really triplexes, fourplexes, sixplexes. Mm-hmm. And it's common. So I think it ought to hit the radar screen. That's my report.
I can piggyback onto that, and that is that I know people who have done the same thing only for, like, alcohol or drug dependency recovery programs, and they'll take a single-family home under the same premise, only they'll they'll typically convert the garage into two or three bedrooms. Mm-hmm. And so they end up having, you know, a large number of people unrelated that are all living there. But I'm not sure how you get around the fair housing thing, because that's a federal.
Well, it's a federal mandate, which is why everybody's looking at it. Now, by the way, the group home that you're talking about has a specific classification as a group home, because that sort of use, those people, they do kind of act like a family.
Right.
And in specific neighborhoods in Bellevue, and the reason that I'm going to all these meetings is my office building happens to be in the neighborhood center, where there are dozens of these houses happening, right, because I'm right next to the college. There are several homes like that, Helping Hands, that sort of thing, and there's no issue with those in the neighborhood, because that group of people actually acts like a family, because they all sort of have commonality, a singularity of purpose, etc. It's basically where they're renting out rooms to completely different groups of people that where it's an issue. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other member comments or reports? Was anybody? I wasn't around when on Saturday for the community planning meeting. Did anybody get to go to that from 10 to 2 Saturday? Nope. Okay. Sorry. So with that, any work program review topics?
I just wanted to confirm that you all saw Paul Stewart's email. He emailed you the adopted work program with a little bit of explanation, I want to say last week. So have all of you been checking your email? And
I didn't see it, Nancy. I have a roof leak into my kitchen.
You want to give us a quick overview on it, just to, or is there anything particular that is of concern?
It's the adopted work program for 2014. So,
so we should just all be sure that we...
Yeah.
Check it and be up for it. Yeah.
I'll get it at tomorrow.
Okay.
So we have a hearing after our special presentation on the Puget Sound Energy Energize East Side. But we also have an opportunity for members of the audience to address us on other topics besides the Cross Kirkland Corridor regulations. Is there anyone here that would care to speak on anything other than that? Audience? Okay, so we will move on to our presentation on Puget Sound Energy Energize East Side.
I'm going to introduce our speaker. And our speaker is Andy Wappler, who is Vice President Corporate Affairs for Puget Sound Energy. And as head of corporate affairs, he leads the company's communication, community affairs, energy efficiency, and products and services teams. He is also chairman and president of the Puget Sound Energy Foundation. He has a master's of science degree in journalism from the Medill School at Northwestern University and a bachelor of arts degree with honors in English from the University of Washington. He is married and has two children. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. And we're a consonant away from being related, Mr. Kapler. I know people often say Wappler instead of Wappler. It makes more sense with Kapler, I guess. But, just one letter away from
you wouldn't believe the same thing. So welcome,
sure.
Brother.
And probably back in the day, Judge Wappner as well would have entered into our broader family tree. Well, thank you for having us and for taking time to let us talk about this tonight. I first moved to this area in 1969. My family moved to Mercer Island. And at that time, Puget Sound Energy served about 400,000 customers in Western Washington. And by customer, we mean meters, homes or businesses. We don't know how many people, as you were just discussing, we don't know how many people are necessarily in that home or business, but 400,000 customers, so 400,000 homes or businesses back then. And today, in the same geographic area, we haven't changed the size of our service area, we now serve approaching 1.2 million customers, of which almost half are right here in King County, our electric customers. And we don't serve Seattle for electric. We serve gas in Seattle, but we don't serve Seattle for electricity. So of our 1.2 million customers on the electric side of our business, almost half are in King County, and about 300,000 of those are along the 405 corridor from Renton through to Redmond and Kirkland. So this is really the high growth area, and that's where we're talking about this Energize East Side project. And we appreciate you letting us have our little kiosk is in the lobby for some public information about it. But I'll try and talk about the project here and tonight, and also, of course, answer your questions about it as well. And just a couple of the headlines off the top. All that growth is straining our ability to bring enough power to the users. And as a regulated utility, we actually have a legal obligation to serve anyone who comes and asks to be connected. We have to serve those customers. We don't get to pick or choose who gets electricity or how much they get. We have to deliver them whatever they need. And conservation is a big part of meeting demand, but we can't simply save our way out of the problem. We do need to build some infrastructure. And before we begin thinking about infrastructure or a transmission line, we did look at alternatives. And there are some great alternatives today in terms of solar and other things that are exciting technologies that will help us extend the life of this project, but don't replace the project in the short term. So a little history and a little start too. I started at PSE 6 years ago, and before I came to the utility, if somebody said transmission, that's right where my mind would have gone. It would have gone to the big kind of erector set style of thing that you see. Not what this is. That can be a transmission line, certainly, coming out across country and things like that, but that's not what this is. And I mention it because I think for many of us, if we heard the idea transmission line, that's what we think. The other thing I think that most of us would think when we say a transmission line is, it's something to take power from one place to another place far away, cross country. It's to take it from Grand Coulee Dam over the Cascades. In this case, it's about bringing power right here to communities that have grown a lot and that are expected to keep growing significantly in the future. Of course, when we first began installing our system on the east side, this was what the east side looked like. Our original electric transmission system, fairly low voltage, low power, but it didn't have to be much because that was your east side in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And in Kirkland, the same thing. These were small towns, and we were essentially serving farms, a few stores, and that was about it. And that was when the current system began to be built out in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Here, of course, is Kirkland about 1964. This picture is a month older than I am, I'm pleased to say. The transmission line that's here today was built in about 1960. So we had the original system in the 20s and 30s. It was then upgraded in around 1960, depending on the segment, to what it is today, which is 115 kV or kilovolt. And that's simply a measure of the system's ability to deliver energy. And that was good enough for back then. But at that time, say around 1960, the east side as a whole, the five cities of the east side, from Kirkland, Redmond, Bellevue, Newcastle, and Renton, had a population combined of about 50,000 people. Now it's 350,000, and estimates show that it'll be approaching 500,000 in roughly 15 to 20 years. So we still have the same electric backbone that we had back when the A&W here was brand new, and Kirkland and the rest of the cities were a fraction of what they were. Now, in that time, we've done a lot to the system, but we have not upgraded that major backbone. Of course, here's Kirkland today. Folks are sure out on the streets today, a beautiful evening, having lots of people out, continues to grow, and continues to grow in ways, too, that are very different from when my family came to the east side in the 60s. Back then, for the most part, the east side is where you slept, but you probably worked in Seattle. Some folks, of course, worked on the east side, but most of the employment was in Seattle. Maybe it was north up in Everett for the Boeing plant, maybe it was south in Renton, but for the most part, most of the big employers were downtown. Of course, now Kirkland is an employment center of its own, so you have more people, I was just reading this weekend that you have the fastest growing school district in the state, in the Lake Washington School District. And, of course, you have jobs. And we're seeing that here in a big way. For Kirkland in particular, the job growth is impressive. On the east side, and these are all figures from the Puget Sound Regional Council going out over a 20-year period, employment as a whole on the east side expected to grow 70% out through 2040, and the general residential population by about 35%. And Kirkland right in line with that. Employment almost half again more than it is today, the population greater by a quarter, and that growth pretty well distributed across the east side, every area continuing to grow. And yet this is that same area of which the electricity, the main power source, is now 5 decades old. So that's why we're talking about a solution that will help us meet that energy demand. And on this chart, let's see, I think this is, yes, there's our laser. So this dotted and dashed line here, it shows the capacity of the system today with that 115 kilovolt system that was put in around 1960. So the most electricity it can deliver at one time. The solid line here then is where we expect demand to be. So here we are today, 2014, and we are on the peak days still below that line. But you go out just a few years, someplace around 2017, 2018, and all of a sudden demand and capacity cross over. And that's really our issue. That demand assumes our peak energy periods, and our peak demand time on the east side is early winter mornings and winter evenings. Although it's interesting, summer is catching up quickly. I remember you used to be able to say that very few people in Western Washington had air conditioning. Not so much anymore. More people have air conditioning, but in particular, most workplaces now have air conditioning. Where back in the 60s and 70s, a lot of workplaces didn't even have air conditioning, but today with things like server rooms and everything else, workplaces have air conditioning, and many homes have it as well. So our summers are catching up, but the peak demand that we're referencing here is for a cold winter morning. And we plan for a morning of 23 degrees at SeaTac. Now our average winter temperatures are still only in the mid-30s for the cold morning temperatures, but we plan for 23 degrees at SeaTac because we tend to hit that most winters, if not every winter. And in fact, this winter we did it a couple of times. Some winters we won't at all. Next year, and it's an early forecast, but next year is predicted to be an El Nino. Maybe it never happens next year. But some years it will, some years it won't. But we know that if it gets down to that temperature, and realistically it does more often than not, people are going to want their lights on, and they're going to want their electric heat, their water heater, and everything else. So that's the planning standard. This graph also assumes that energy efficiency continues to be a big thing. And as Nancy mentioned when she introduced me, I lead our energy efficiency group. That's about 100 people. That's about $100 million worth of programs and grants and rebates. We've done a lot with the city. We do a lot with private employers, school districts, as well as homeowners. And it can be as simple as if you get the light bulb at Costco that's discounted, or if you're building a new facility, if you're an employer, maybe one of our energy efficiency engineers comes out and actually talks about the facility and helps you design it. We know that that's going to be a big part of the future. Without energy efficiency, we would have crossed over that line already. And if we can do more energy efficiency in the future, we can push that point out farther. But with where we are today, and our energy efficiency programs are already larger than mandated by law, and you may remember in 2006, voters approved Initiative 937, of which kind of the headline grabber was the renewable energy component. But the other half of that law was that utilities had to do all cost-effective energy efficiency. So it's not just something we do because it's a good customer thing, it is also the law as well. So we have energy efficiency targets set by law, we exceed those, and this graph assumes that energy efficiency continues as it is today. Now, what happens when we cross over? When you cross over with demand crossing over the capacity of the system, power outages become more likely. And these are a little different than the kind of power outages when it's a windy day and a tree limb has come down. What we're looking at here is more a system that, like any machine, when it's under stress and you're running it hard, components fail. And it really would be akin to if you had a vehicle and you consistently overloaded the trailer, it was more than your pickup truck could tow. Could you do that once in a while? Sure. Could you do that all the time? Probably not, without seeing some sort of breakdown. And the electric system is really the same. And the nature of these power outages are that you could see a more widespread power outage on the east side, particularly at a high demand time when that system is under stress. The other part of this is, at a certain point, if the system can't deliver electricity, what impact does that have on our ability to serve a growing economy as well as more customers? So kind of twofold. It's the capacity to help the region continue to grow and grow the economy, in particular when we're seeing more jobs come to places like Kirkland. And then the other half is that reliability aspect. How do you continue to have reliability? Two things will help us meet this. We know energy efficiency is a big part of the picture, no doubt. As I mentioned, we already would have been past that crossover point if we didn't have aggressive energy efficiency. But we also know that infrastructure, the ability to get power to people in the first place, is going to be an important part of the solution. So a little bit here on how power gets to our region, and then I'll talk a bit about the project. But I'm going to draw in some, through the magic of the clicker, the purple lines are where the more heavy-duty 230 kilovolt lines are today. And they run from our Sammamish substation, a little bit east of here. It's in kind of the Willows Road area of Redmond. Those lines then run east, out toward the Redmond Ridge area, across the plateau, via Pine Lake, Beaver Lake, the Kahani neighborhood, down to Issaquah, and then out to the west to Talbot Hill, which is our major substation in Renton. They don't run along the 405 corridor. Instead, along the 405 corridor in the blue is that lower capacity, older transmission network. And I mentioned that we put that network in the 60s. It's this, where it says 115 kV. That capacity, much less than where the purple is. So today, our backbone runs right along here from Redmond to Renton. And there are other, you see the other blue lines, there are other transmission lines as well throughout the community. But the main connection between the bigger substation at Talbot Hill and the one at Sammamish and Redmond is this line here. And that's the line that was built around 1960 on easements and along a corridor that had been used since the 20s and 30s. So our issue really is the growth. And this map shows where the growth is. It's kind of the intensity of energy use. And the red here is the more intense. Well, that purple higher capacity line is over here. Generally speaking, that's where there's less energy demand. Not quite as populated there. You get along the 405 corridor, and we are mostly into that red all the way through it. Where we aren't is, for the most part, where there are parks or wetlands, where there's minimal development. This is that area near Bellevue with like the blueberry fields and things. We have Coal Creek Park, May Creek Park. Most of the rest of that 405 corridor between Lake Sammamish and Lake Washington is into that higher electric density. But that's where that older, lower capacity line is. So our challenge really is, how do we connect that main substation at Renton to the main substation here in Redmond to bring more electricity, more power to that high growth, high energy demand region? And we have a number of different options to do that. And I'll step back just a moment here before I get to those about the reliability issue. And I want to mention this because this was something, as a folks here in Kirkland, you may remember. This was June 2011 when we had a fire at that substation in Sammamish. And you may remember it was very smoky. Many people out of power here in the Kirkland area and the western part of Redmond. About 25,000 or so out for about 2 hours for the most part. And of course that smoke column was very visible. There's mineral oil in the transformers. It's safe, but it burns in an extremely smoky manner. Well, when that fire happened, it happened on a perfect day, if you can have that fire. And by that I mean, it was a cloudy June day. Can you imagine that, a cloudy June day? How often does that happen around here? It's a cloudy June day, it's about 68 degrees. That is about the low end of energy demand in our area. If you're going to have a time, it's about midday as well. you're going to have a time when you have low energy demand, that's it. So it was still a couple hours of power, but for a relatively limited area. And because our system is still operating with enough capacity to deliver energy to this core, we had some options. We could send backup power from the south to the north and keep that power outage fairly limited. Well, if this were to happen a few years from now, let's say it's now 2018, we have a limited ability to bring backup power from either end because the demand is greater than the capacity of that power line in the future. And what that means is our ability to restore power becomes a lot less as well. So when this happened a few years back, it happened at the perfect time, and we had enough excess capacity in the system that we could bring energy and back things up from one end to the other. You go out in the future, when we're already pushing capacity on that system, and if this were to happen, say, on a cold winter morning, you have a much bigger outage for more people longer. So that's why this is an acute need in the area, to be able to have that backup, as well as to just supply the ability to meet the growth that is likely coming to our region as the economy continues to rebound. So now I'll get to the segments. So there are 16 different segments on this lovely alphabetical map, and they all do the same thing in the sense that they connect from Sammamish to Renton, and they make that connection here from point A to point N. They all do the same thing. They do it in different ways, however. We have 16 different segments. They can be configured in 19 different ways. And however they were configured, if you came from N to L and to K to J to E to C, that would be fine. If you started here and went to M and over to K to H to G to D, that would be fine. Any of the combinations that get you from here to there work fine. And so we're often asked, as we've been out talking to the public with this, do you have a preference? We don't. All these routes work from a technical standpoint. Now, we have a very strong preference to meet our responsibility to keep everyone's lights on and to get this job done. But in terms of which route and how, they all work, and they're all buildable. But we want to involve the community in helping us with, well, which ones are better choices. Before I get into that, just mention a couple things. Why these routes? Well, this line that's basically C, E, J, M, and N, that line, kind of the eastern straight up and down line, that is that existing corridor today. That's that existing corridor today that's the 115 kilovolt system, been there since the 60s, and in fact many of the easements since the 20s and 30s, and we would use that corridor and rebuild it to the upgraded higher capacity system. Out to the west, L and so on up through F, that is essentially the Burlington Northern Rail Corridor. And we used that as a possibility because what we wanted to do in selecting any of these potential routes were two things. Minimize the amount of impact we could have in the community and do that by using as much footprint as we could that was either a current utility corridor or some kind of public use right-of-way today, rather than going to some place that didn't have any infrastructure or any public use today. And in total, these segments are about 70% on existing either utility or public right-of-ways. Some, such as the CEJM, that's where the line is today, it's 100% on an existing corridor. Others, such as the L, which is part of that Burlington Northern line, that wasn't a PSC utility corridor, although in a few spots it is, but it was a public right-of-way. So that's how we came up with those segments. I'll also note that in between, not on here, but in between, there is an existing Seattle City Light corridor today. And it actually looks a little like the picture I showed to the beginning with kind of the latticework towers for the most part. That corridor is in between these two sets of segments. We did talk to Seattle City Light and see, do you have room on your corridor? Do you want to rebuild your corridor with us? They do not. They have the same issue, essentially, of demand and customer growth that we have. And their infrastructure also has the same issue of having been built several decades ago and seeing a lot of future growth. So while they do have some physical space on their corridor, not much. It's fairly narrow. They believe they need that for their future customers' use as well. And their corridor goes through the east side. It may seem a little bit puzzling. It goes through the east side so they can get power from their dams to South Seattle. Yes.
Is that the one that runs along 124th and through the middle of Bridal Trails?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm trying to figure out just where then the other one, the PSE one,
the PSE
C section.
Corridor, it, the C section then
where
is
does that run?
East of 132nd and west of 140th. So it is right on this little square here is Bridal Trails.
Right.
So it is on the east border. 140th would be right there to the right, 132nd to the west.
Okay. Thank you.
And this is a little bit of what's on those corridors today. So the B segment, which runs then just on the eastern edge here of kind of the Houghton area, on the just east then of 405, comes over then kind of a stair step. So here's the B segment today, and it has, this is one of those smaller 115 kilovolt lines that's there today. And part of the reason I mentioned at the beginning, kind of the erector set sort of thing of thinking transmission line, this is the transmission line too. But I don't think most of us would probably think of it in those terms when we're kind of used to thinking about the big kind of comes out of Grand Coulee Dam thing. But these are actually transmission lines here today. And in fact, on these you can see what we think of as transmission lines at the top that are higher voltage, and then here, the lower voltage distribution line that actually takes it down to your house or your store or something like that. So this is what's on the B segment today. And again, in using that as a potential segment here, along 405 and then over, the goal was where could we be where there's already some kind of electric infrastructure?
If you were to go with a 230, would it look the same, only just would have bigger lines, or would it change the actual supporting structures?
It would change them. And this is a look at kind of what I'd say are examples of what a 230 could look like. There are a lot of different choices in terms of the designs, but just to give some sense of sort of scale and perspective, the existing poles for a 115 system are probably in the range of 70 feet. These, it would depend, it might be more like 90 to 125. So figure from 70 to around 100, but it's very terrain dependent. What are you crossing over? What's beneath? What are you trying to get over? So there is a lot of latitude. There's also a lot of trade-off in terms of you can go with shorter poles if they're closer together because the line swags a bit. But you can bring them closer together and be shorter. You also have the ability to then have, if you want fewer, be taller. And it would be a double-circuited line. And this is where the terminology in electricity, I think, can be a little confusing. It would be double-circuited, and people look and see, well, gee, don't you have six circuits? I see six wires. Each circuit has three phases, kind of like a three-prong plug. So each group of three is a circuit. So if we say double-circuited, it's two threes. You could put that with three on one pole and have another pole nearby, or you could put all six on a single pole. There are also different abilities to, depending on the corridor, make them wider but shorter, put them on the inside, put them on the outside. There are a lot of flexibility in terms of what's there. But they would be a single steel pole. The one on the right that looks brown is, in fact, a steel pole. It's called the self-weathering pole. To some people, they look a little more appealing. They tend to build more northwest and blend in. Others like kind of the cleaner look of something that's either painted or galvanized. But that's sort of where we are in terms of what the possibilities are for the poles. If we were along the segments here that have these existing transmission lines, during that rebuild, we would make an effort to design it in such a way that we're able to kind of clean that up so you don't have one existing set and another brand new set. We can work in the design so you still have one that is visible as opposed to, okay, now I have both. So you understand that there's a little mitigation we'll need to do in terms of, you know, yes, that's used for existing transmission, but we don't want to alter the experience any more than we have to for the people who are there. Other topic, of course, that comes up is, well, what about undergrounding? all the solutions that we put out are for an above-ground solution. And the reason why is that in Washington, under the regulations that we have with the Utilities Commission, undergrounding for transmission is considered a local option. And typically, when we do any other effort on the system, any other kind of building a substation, tree trimming, you name it, all the other things that we do, all customers pay for those equally, even if it isn't near their house. And the theory in the regulation is we all benefit from a reliable system, so if we're building a substation in Bremerton, well, that's good for Bremerton, but it's good for our whole region collectively. And if we're improving reliability in Kirkland, well, that's good for everybody in Washington to have reliability in Kirkland, so all customers will pay for that together. Just because this project is on the east side, it doesn't mean the east side is the only one paying for it. Helps the whole community in a broad sense. Undergrounding is a little bit different. Everyone in our service area benefits from the capacity that a new system brings or the reliability that it brings. But in the regulation, the theory is that only those who are right next to it would benefit from the fact that it's underground, because it's primarily a visual benefit. Transmission lines are very reliable. They don't end up with the same tree branch in the lines kinds of issues that a smaller scale line would. So you don't get a lot of reliability benefit out of putting this kind of line underground. And in fact, there are some challenges with reliability. In hot weather, these lines, the biggest enemy to them is heat. And of course, an underground line gets hot, and it's hard to dissipate that heat. The theory then in the regulation is that if you ask for undergrounding, the regulation says that when an above-ground solution is available, the people requesting undergrounding must pay for the undergrounding. And it's a significant difference, which is kind of what's laid out here. Underground construction, someplace in that $20 to $28 million a mile range. Above ground, $3 to $4 million a mile. So that delta of around $25 million then would be something that the local requester would have to pay for. And we have very little underground transmission in the United States. About a half of 1% of all the transmission lines in the country are underground. It's a little more in Europe. It's something like 2 to 2.5%. But that's essentially why. The other aspect of the undergrounding, in addition to the cost, that's a challenge of the direct construction, there's the issue of what you run into when you're underground. So if you were to do undergrounding and we had to move other utilities, things like that also add to those costs, and they can add very significantly and quickly to those costs. So that $25 million a mile, we'll throw that out as kind of a very ballpark rough sense, but if you are running into other underground utilities that then you must relocate, if they have an easement to be in the ground already, then the project has to pay for that. And that could significantly add to the cost. The other aspect of the undergrounding that I think is significant is the impact in terms of the construction. And it is a very significant construction project. When you do an underground, as that top picture shows, if you do underground transmission lines, if you're thinking about something like very low voltage or like maybe cable TV, they can come and they can use a trenchless construction or do a very small slit in the ground, and you can put something low voltage like a telecom line underground very easily. In this case, because it's high voltage and it needs to be cooled, you actually build a poured-in-place concrete box the length of the underground section. It is then filled with special material for cooling. It's probably in the range of 10 to 15 feet wide to accommodate the conduit and the lines. All vegetation within that corridor has to be removed because you can't have tree roots and invasion of that sort of thing into the lines. And every quarter to a half mile, you have to build what you see on the bottom left, which are underground vaults, so that what's on the right, the sections of cable are spliced together. It isn't a one continuous cable, it's sections of quarter to a half mile. And this is done so that if there is a fault with the cable, you have a place to get in, remove a section, put in a new section, and make a splice. And cables do have a very significant lifetime, but they do need repair. And the things that get to them are corrosion, roots, and other kind of invasion underground, as well as just heat and failure from that. So I think it's important to be clear on the regulatory framework with undergrounding. Technically, it is possible. It is expensive. It's a big cost to the community that uses it. and it's not low impact. In some cases, you may actually remove more vegetation and have, by some perspectives, as much visual impact from underground and the resulting corridor as you do from above ground. Neither way is inexpensive or simple or low impact. And basically what I stated too would also apply to, people have asked, well, what about an underwater cable? Same sort of regulations. And just sort of by background, that idea of splitting the cost on undergrounding, we do that today at the neighborhood level. If you were a builder and you're going to develop a new community, the builder would pay then for the undergrounding, and then you might, if you're going to buy the home or something, that would be part you'd be paying for. If we're working with the city, it is split by our franchise and our tariff agreement with the city. I believe the split is 60-40 between the city and the utility. If there's a project that results in, say, widening Main Street and want to bring the utilities underground. So it does fall in line with other ways that we split those costs for undergrounding. It is not exclusive to simply high voltage transmission. The other concern, of course, often for the public is electromagnetic fields. And I'm not an epidemiologist or an industrial hygienist, but I will just give some point of comparison to this. I think in the popular mind, we tend to associate EMF with transmission lines. And as you sort of see here, we live as people who use electricity all the time. We live in electromagnetic fields frequently. And our exposure from many things that we'd experience at home, at school, at work, is on par or greater to the exposure that people would see from a transmission line. I know that there have been approximately 2,900 studies in the United States since the early 60s on EMF, about $500 million in research, and as of 2012, both the World Health Organization and the U.S. Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Health, both were solidly on the side of saying there is no conclusive evidence today of a direct health link with EMF. So, common concern, we certainly want to educate our customers about it, but I think there's a tendency to associate it only with power lines as opposed to any device that uses electricity. And last, the really important part, why we appreciate your giving us time tonight, as I mentioned with transmission lines, we tend to think of the big erector set guys. We also tend to think of them as something that's built to take power from here to there. It's not. It's about bringing power to our customers and, in many cases, our neighbors. So we want to have the public be involved. We're not building this in a faraway place. We're building this right here, a few miles from our headquarters in communities where our employees live and where our customers are. So we want to have a lot of ways for the public to be involved in the process. You can see a few of those ways here. I'll give a little detail about the community advisory group process here. We do have the community advisory group. We have representation from about 25 people in there, including all five of the cities, from neighborhoods, including here in Kirkland. We have representatives from every neighborhood on that group, every city on that group, as well as the low-income community, environmental advocates, business community, and the school districts. Underneath that group of 25, we have dedicated sub-area committees just for the neighborhoods. And so there's a sub-area committee in which Redmond and Kirkland are represented, and then two others for Bellevue, Newcastle, and Renton. I believe in total we have representatives from 55 different neighborhoods on those sub-area committees. We do want to hear from people about the routes. We think we know a lot about them, but they know more because it is where they live. We also want to find out about what people feel in terms of some of the trade-offs. Would you like taller poles that are fewer apart, or do you think in that area, you know what, lower is better, so we'll take them a little bit closer together, and just what are the different choices and the trade-offs between the routes? That process is, you see, divided north, central, and south within that overall community advisory group convening for all regions, and the process has been pretty robust here the last couple of months. These are just the sub-area committee workshops and meetings. We also have the meetings of that broader community advisory group, which have been going on since February, and we've had a chance to reach out to councils such as yours, as well as the city councils. And the rest of this year in our schedule is about the public process. We don't anticipate filing any permits for the selected route until early next year. So 2014 is really about being ahead of and greater than the outreach that will come in that process to give the community a chance to learn about the project, why we're doing it, and how they can be involved. As we get later into this year, it's likely that we'll begin that process of winnowing down the routes and coming up with a route selection. And we are really hoping for, out of the community advisory group, some strong input on what the best route would be. But I will be candid and say that if that group does deadlock, or that group comes to a conclusion where they say, you know, we can't come to a consensus among the group, then for us, as having the responsibility to serve that broader public, we will have to make a decision, because we can't tell our 300,000 some customers we can't keep your lights on. But we know this is a valuable process for getting input, for giving a voice to our customers, and we hope that they, in that process, can give us a really clear recommendation that we can take forward and get something built and keep those lights on. So please, your questions.
Yes. Do you already have a semi-basic idea where you want to put it?
No, we have the 16 potential routes, but they all work. I mean, electrically, in terms of serving the community's needs, they all work. Now, they all have challenges. Some have greater construction challenges. Some probably have greater challenges legally and land acquisition and all that. But there are no easy routes. And one of the questions often is, well, can you put it someplace over there? We need to be here because it's where the users are. And certainly as folks who know the community well, you'd know there's not a lot of open or over there. It's a dense and increasingly congested area, which is what the need is. So it will certainly be a challenge.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I'm just curious, and I know this is quite a bit off subject, but you're looking at where the need is, and you're looking at increasing capacity. What about increasing generation capacity where the need is greatest, such as large box stores, solar installations, that kind of thing, where the need is, rather than wind farms out someplace where you still have to transmit it all the way and the attendant loss of power along that lengthy transmission?
Sure. It's an excellent question. It's one of the first things we looked at was, what can we do that's different? Could you do a massive amount of energy efficiency and get there? Could you do something that is distributed generation today? And there are a couple of things that came up. Could you do solar? Could you do more solar? And the issue with solar really was timing. Yes, we actually have more potential for solar here in Washington than our relatives in other parts of the country who are going to make jokes about that idea. No, it actually does work here, but it works at the wrong time in terms of our peak demand. We tend to do great on solar from about now through early September. Our peak energy demand is the other side of the year. We also looked at battery storage. Could you do something like battery storage in the community? We'd be doing it on a scale that it is not currently being done. There are some pilot projects around the country. But roughly 400 shipping container-sized batteries at today's technology, several million dollars each, so probably in the billion-dollar-plus range, and you'd still have the issue then of where do we put them. And in terms of distributed generation, we did look at a couple other pieces. Could we build a small natural gas fired power plant on the east side? And then other items such as, what about generation on location at different customer locations? There is actually, in terms of air quality, some federal regulation that preempted doing that in terms of generation on site, say more generators and things like that. And in terms of doing something like a natural gas-fired power plant on the east side, you would still need the transmission line. It would be short, but you'd still need it through the community to bring the power from that plant to the users. Anything, though, we do along those lines here over the next few years will have the benefit, though, of extending the usability of this project into the future. So as those new technologies do come online, that will be good news. It will further push out the time that we might have to do something like this again.
Question? John?
Thank you very much. It was a very nice and thorough presentation. I have heard this before in other jurisdictions, and continuity was almost talked about more in the presentation than capacity. you seem to focus on capacity over continuity. So now I guess I'm a little bit confused as to pathways and continuity. If this line gets blocked, tree falls, and whatever, we need to go around this way. And then you also mentioned you focus on the high transmission lines instead of the distribution line. So maybe if you could go back and help me understand that a little bit better in terms of pathways and the differences in what you're specifically talking about, the high transmission lines versus the high voltage lines versus the local distribution lines.
That sure. Would help
me. Thank you.
And in terms of the idea of continuity or redundancy, the issue really today is that our main pathway, this kind of backward C shape around the east side, if something fails anywhere along that line, we don't have the ability to connect these two main ends of the system that feed the east side today. So if you were to have a failure here on that line, we don't have sufficient ability to drive power north without that line. Essentially, we have one north to south path that has the capacity to meet the east side's future. So if we can build from Redmond to Renton, we would have a path here and a path here, as well as the way to come in from either north or south. So if you kind of complete that box, then you have a bit of that belt and suspenders of, if I don't have this north to south, I have that north to south. If I don't have this east to west, I have that east to west. We have a two-legged stool, a three-sided box, however you want to think of it today. So that's really the reliability aspect of it. But I have to say and that is a key issue. There are federal requirements. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has requirements around that. But I would say that in our area, that capacity aspect is at least as great. Now, overall, and you may see news stories around this, overall energy demand in some ways is flattening out across the country. But this is about local demand, and we are one of those great exceptions in that people are moving here and continue to move here, and employers tend to come here in large numbers. The difference then between the transmission and the distribution side of things, this is about getting it to the general area in the first place. Distribution then is really about from the substation to your house. And over the last decade, we've done about $200 million worth of improvements to the local distribution here on the east side. And that's everything from adding capacity to substation to installing what's called tree wire, which is kind of a coated wire that sheds tree branches. All of that kind of work has been done. What we haven't done then is that bigger picture delivery system to bring it to those improved substations in the first place. So this adds another pathway where we have one today for that power on the east side, and it adds a bigger pathway so that we can take advantage of then those neighborhood level distribution improvements we've made. And they all fit together. It is truly a chain where the weakest link becomes the chain. If you don't have this, your neighborhood improvements may be for naught. If you haven't made the neighborhood improvements and you only do this, you still have a problem. And now this is really stepping up to a level that we've done the neighborhood, we haven't done this.
So the north-south corridor that you're talking about, where you showed the options with your letter diagram, that it's not really an either-or on those. It's just you just need one contiguous path from north to south.
That's correct.
That's it. So based on your timeline of when you're hoping to submit for building permits, I would suspect that you might have a leading horse in the race as to which path might be the way, and as we grow towards Kirkland, which path is leading the way?
They all work. You know, from the engineer standpoint, they all get the job done. To me personally, the leading path will be the one that people say, we can live with that one.
And in your public meetings and such, what has the biggest voice been on this one's most acceptable?
I would say there are probably more people who say, gee, you should build where the existing pathway is, which would be the C, E, J, and M line. But when we have talked to those individuals, they understandably have said, aren't there options? And we really felt it was incumbent, beyond simply saying, you know, we're going to be right where we've been, couldn't think of anything else, to say, are there other ways to do this? Understanding that between a Lake Sammamish, a Cougar Mountain, and a Lake Washington, we don't have a lot of geographic choices, but really felt it was incumbent to say, you know, we have found some other paths and some other options rather than just we're going to go right where we've been.
Okay. And then a follow-up on that is the overhead versus underground. And it's not a leading question as to a proponent one way or the other. It's an honest discussion and a question about this. So I'm not leading you. What sort of comments have you heard in your public meetings about is it worth the financial investment to underground versus overhead? And what happens when you get to some cities' comp plans about driving underground wires? And I don't think our comp plan talks about transmission lines. It's more of the distribution lines. In comp plans and how they relate to undergrounding. And I'm going to go one more step, Andy, and that is when you're running through bridle trails in the trees, the lines are going to get kind of lost. When you get to an urban center that's very developed, that's when they're very noticeable. Has there been any study about over under?
Sure, and I'll start with that. You can go partially above ground, partially underground. There are limits to that. The underground, if you do too much over under, the actual undergrounded cables can function as a capacitor, which is kind of like a battery where they actually store energy. So technically you end up some issues where you couldn't go block to block. You'd have to be, once you're under, you got to be under for a while. But best of my knowledge, not being an engineer, that could be half mile, mile, mile and a half. We're talking about 18 miles for any of these from top to bottom. So you could do sections that are underground. It is not an all or nothing deal. Some limits technically, but not an all or nothing deal. Let's see. I remembered the last one. You had two more. Help me out.
So how does that, are there any conflicts with comp plans that you've discussed in working with jurisdictions?
Best of my knowledge, your kind of summary of the comp plans is accurate, I think, for all the jurisdictions that they've tended to focus on local distribution being undergrounded as a preference and not addressing transmission. And in terms of kind of the public sentiment around undergrounding, understandably, people say, I'd like undergrounding. Totally understand that.
I'd like a Ferrari, too. Yeah.
Totally understand why people would want undergrounding. Where I think the regulation comes in and where I think people will look at it and sort of pause for a moment is that simple idea of if we did it here and everyone paid for it, changed the regulation somehow and everyone paid for it across the service area, what happens when everybody else wants it undergrounded?
Yeah. Well, you did mention, though, that local service districts that opted for the underground and paid the difference.
Yes, they do. And that is the regulation today. But it has been posed as we've had public outreach that people say, well, the regulation should be different and all should pay. And I think at that point, my caution, I've had those conversations, is that could be potentially quite a good deal of rate shock, you know, down the road. And then who chooses whose undergrounding is paid for by all and whose is not. And that might be very difficult. Which I think gets to why historically and why nationally our regulatory framework is extremely standard in the sense of it is a very significant cost increase. The benefit is primarily to the local community or user. Therefore, kind of that cost causers pay idea takes place.
Okay. And then the last one that I wrote down was you had talked about overburdening the system like the car pulling the heavy trailer would wear out certain items, but you didn't really mention brownout situations where capacity would actually result in the end user not having your lights to dim and that sort of thing. What's the real possibility of that happening? Brownouts versus blowing up your truck pulling a heavy trailer?
Both could happen. Typically, if you are in that low voltage situation, a couple things happen. So the brownout, which is where you simply are not delivering as much energy as being consumed and the lights sag, a couple of things today make that a very unfortunate outcome. Years ago, when people had simpler devices at home, it was perhaps a novelty, but it didn't do a lot of damage. Today, particularly in businesses with computers and other things, low voltage could actually result in damage to equipment. So it would be extremely reluctant to let that happen. Instead, you then, in the phrasing of the industry, you shed load, meaning you decide who you're going to turn off in order to protect the system, with the theory being that it's better for someone to be off than someone to be on and having equipment be damaged. Better to be inconvenienced than damaged. Then you're in a tough position of saying, okay, who do we pick? And whose load goes out? But that is a possibility. I know in our studies around this that at the Talbot Hill substation, for example, and I think it's roughly the same numbers for Sammamish, when you are overloaded, you're in the range of potentially having the transformer run at 125, 135% of its capacity. And then you are either facing the likelihood that that transformer will fail, or that you're going to be doing something like shedding that load. And in particular, that shedding of load or turning people off by opening switches at substations, that's coming, the scenario would be that's coming on a December day when it's 20 degrees. And if we have had public outreach and meetings about this project, I would bet that if we have to do that, we will have considerable amount of public outreach if we come to cold winter days where we're turning people off.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick question from me on the, you said you're looking for consensus on, now is that consensus within the committees that you formed, or is it them plus some sort of public participation?
Well, we have in the sub-area committees that I mentioned, right, those are not just the neighborhood associations, but those are all comers, so to speak. So we have just members of the public who have heard about them and come. We've tried to mail our customers, include information in our bill stuffers, all those sorts of things. We want to get input from the public, and we've been getting great turnout at those events. It's then that community advisory group that has representatives, including from two Kirkland neighborhoods, the representation there where that group, that's where we'd like to see that consensus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty diverse group of neighborhood people, the businesses, schools, others in the community. If they can say, you know, we really think this is the path to bring it forward, that'd be a fantastic outcome.
And what would qualify if it, you're talking about like a majority or two-thirds or 75% or what do you, have you actually got a specific percentage that is going
I don't know that we do, honestly. You know, I think in consensus it would certainly be that, you know, could you come to an agreement of a majority on that group of, you know, we really think this is where we need to go? That would be great. But I will be clear, you know, for us, we do have that obligation to serve. And, you know, as a longtime resident, I remember when Puget Power's slogan was, it's our job to keep the lights on. We'll have to keep doing that job. So we really want that group to say, hey, this is the path we think you ought to take. But we know at the end we will have to make a decision and actually file a route and file a permitted route.
Okay, I'm still a little confused because, I mean, if you say that a majority of the group agrees on a route, then...
That'd be fantastic. We would be more than happy then to use that route.
Okay.
That would be the goal of the process. To have, you know, the input where you could have that level of agreement and clarity for us about where to go and what to do.
Well, it would seem that getting a majority, you may have a very vocal minority, but getting a majority, should you ought to be able to achieve that.
I would,
right?
Hope so.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Very good. Thanks very much. We appreciate
Thank you very
the
much
presentation.
For having us.
Thank you.
So, with that, it's time for Jeremy.
Did you want to hand out those plans?
Yeah,
okay.
Thank you.
take orders for how long you want my presentation to go.
Well,
would this be to go or dine in?
Drive through.
I think that generally speaking, we all prepare, look through the materials, and so I would like it to be an overview, and with the understanding that we can then ask questions along the way.
Okay. Perfect. Just stop me then as I'm flying through the slides. I don't have a lot of slides.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So the map here highlights the zones that are affected. This is the Cross Kirkland corridor running through town. You'll see I reference a couple times the corridor, which involves the East Side Rail corridor. That's the county-owned part to the north. Doesn't affect Houghton.
Right.
The Houghton stretch runs from 68th down to the south city limits. You all will recall the interim ordinance that council adopted last November was passed also by the community council. That's expiring on May 15th. Planning Commission had their public hearing on the 10th. Usually we try to combine the public hearings, but because of that looming deadline, we weren't able to do it in this case. We're coming to you for a second recommendation outside the Planning Commission's. I won't dwell on this because this issue of expanded uses largely affects the industrial zones, none of which are in Houghton jurisdiction. Prohibiting retail storage uses, there's only one spot in your jurisdictions that this affects, and that's in Yarrow Bay District 2. It's allowed, but only as a secondary use, yeah. So probably not a lot of issues there. Setbacks would apply in all those zones you saw on the map. The recommendations are for a standardized 10-foot building setback in those areas. The Planning Commission came up with an option. This is probably more for retail zones, which you don't have. It's hard to visualize this in the southern part of the corridor. But places where uses could come into that 10-foot setback for retail, restaurant, those corridor-oriented uses. I see that more happening in, say, Parmac or Totem Lake than in the southern parts. The design standards we recommended would apply in all of the yellow highlighted areas. Site design standards, building design standards. John had some recommendations at the study session about a month ago that I tried to incorporate into these provisions, particularly the facade lengths and trying to be a more or less vague about what the expectation is. So we've tried to build that into the regulations. And lastly, what wasn't in the interim ordinance but is in this version of permanent regulations is dealing with the corridor and utilities as they run through sensitive areas. So here's a stretch of corridor in Totem Lake with wetlands on either side. So clarifying utility exemptions that go through the corridor and allowing paved trail surfaces within those areas subject to mitigation. So that, in a nutshell, is what's on the table.
Very well done.
Holy criminy, that was speedy.
Gee, Germany, that's great.
Any questions on that presentation?
I'm disappointed we don't have one person for our hearing.
I do have one question on the presentation, just because I want to be a little snide. But on page 4 of our thing, it said, or on page 3, it said everything in red is applicable. And then on page 4, it said not this one. In red.
Oh, John.
Sorry. I failed you.
I have a question about the interim development you're going to do with the improvements.
Yeah.
What's the schedule and what have you decided what it's going to look like?
The interim trail will start up this summer, and that's going to be a crushed gravel surface. I don't know, have you walked this stretch behind the Google campus or between the Google campuses? Google put down a crushed gravel surface there. So when the rails came out, the city had the contractor go back in, smooth out the existing ballast. The interim trail will go back in and put a fairly fine crushed rock on top of that surface. So it's bikeable. You may not want to take your racing bike on it, but it'll be roughly 8 to 10 foot wide, smooth gravel trail.
Yeah, I ran it before the meeting tonight.
Okay.
That is a much smoother surface.
It's 5/8 minus, right?
I think it is 5/8 minus.
What about the big gravel pieces that are really hard to walk on and run on? Are those going to be You're just going to add the finer gravel on top of it and compact it?
It's top coat. I don't think any of that material comes out. I think the gravel is all top coat on top of it.
So summer is a long time. When is there a schedule?
Oh, I think last I saw, there's a meeting today that I missed, but I think they were projecting finishing in the early fall. So by next fall. And they're going to try not to close off the whole thing at once. They're trying to define a number of segments so they can keep segments, you know, the majority of it open during construction and not just let the contractor have full access to the 5.7 miles of it.
Jeremy, are they going to roll that gravel down, or is it just going to be loose so it just
It'll be rolled. Very highly compacted.
Yeah, good.
John?
I have a list of notes and comments that...
Let's hear it.
How about if I just start?
Yeah.
So, if we just start on page 2 of your document. So, one of the comments that I had is on the development standards. Instead of just a planning official, it would be applied by the planning director. And the comment from staff back was that there were already some standards, and it appeared that... the administrative design review process was kind of all set up, and that there wasn't really a change needed to change it to planning director. That's what I'm reading here. So I didn't notice that there was a way in when you're working with a staff person on an administrative review and you come to a decision, Is there a place in the code that is defined as to how that's appealable and how you move it up the ladder?
Administrative design review and planning official decisions, unless they have a specific appeal process assigned to them, the buck stops there. So it tends to be an administrative process. So administrative design review doesn't have, you can't appeal it. It's the decision is made as it would be with a building permit or something of that nature.
Yeah, that's what I'm after. And so my whole point of this is the non-offensively being said here, but the inconsistency of how sometimes these sort of things happen and just working with different pieces of staff. It's not particular to Kirkland. It's human nature. It happens in every jurisdiction. There's not really a way stated in the code as to how if you work with Billy and you work with Sarah and your same kind of projects over a different course of time frame, you get kind of different answers, how you resolve those differences. There's no way in the code written how to do that as opposed to say, gee, kind of talk to your supervisor when you're on the phone sort of thing. And my suggestion was to get around that whole thing that, you know, the planning director is the ultimate say on it.
As a practical matter, wouldn't that be the case, John? If you had different interpretations of something, then you would then seek the
supervisor. That's as a practical matter how you do it. I'm just, maybe you don't need to explain it.
Right. I mean, as a functional matter within the department, most of the design-related things, administrative design review board, these regulations, I'm the supervisor for that group, and then if I have issues with it, I talk to Eric. If somebody doesn't like the planner's response, they'll come to me. If they don't like my response, they'll go to Eric. So without being codified, that's kind of how the...
Simple enough. Okay. Yeah. All right. Our office has not had that issues because you and I have not had many conversations. but I've just heard from other people, and maybe I don't know what it is. Okay, so I am on...
About the landscape island, which is right down there.
Yeah, so the landscape island actually is talked about on that same page, and it's discussed a little further on page 6 with the subnote number 1. I understand exactly what you're saying. I don't have an issue. I can move off of that. That's fine. The landscape islands, the planning commission said it's a bigger issue than just this deal. We should kick the can down the road. I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that. I'm looking on page 6, item number 4, a third circle. And there's some discussion there about pedestrian connections to buildings, to corridors, that sort of thing. And so the note that I made is, what about connecting corridors to parking? Because while we all like to go to these wonderful people promenades and walk and ride our bike, it is amazing to me how many people places like that you go to that people drive there as a destination. And so it just seems to me that we should plan for that. If somebody that lives wherever doesn't want to quite ride their bike all the way to that destination, they're going to drive there, take their bike off the brand new rack that they got on their back of their car and set it down and then ride on the promenade. And so I think that that should be planned for, because whether we don't want that to happen or not, it will happen. So that's my comment, is somewhere that they ought to be connected to somehow parking, street parking, etc. All right, item number, page 7 is my next item, and it kind of, it goes through several pages in the document. The very last sentence on page 7 talks about how the interim trail construction is exempt from the regulations. And even in Bob John's offices, he's the attorney in the back of their letter, the lady whose last name I can't remember, talked about, how is that possible that there's two set of standards, one for us regular people that develop things and one for the city who's developed things that they're exempt from all the sensitive area regulations. I'm confused about that. How is that even possible?
Well, there are, Chapter 90 has exemptions in it. So the rules apply, and then there's limited exemptions for repair maintenance for your house in a wetland area or a driveway in a wetland area, something like that. So there are privately applicable exemptions, but then there are also exemptions for public things. So utilities, street maintenance, road maintenance, things like that are exempted for. And I would guess in the state's thinking of the regulatory framework for it, it's kind of like you get to these things where the needs of the community as a whole outweigh the just not letting somebody do it. So if you need a road project, you need to maintain a road through a wetland or a wetland buffer area, then there's an exemption for it, because you can't just say, no, you can't have a road or you can't maintain the road. So there are, not just in Kirkland's codes, but actually coming from the state, from Growth Management Act and their model ordinance through most city and county codes, there are a list of exemptions that apply to public projects and don't apply as broadly to private projects, although a number of private projects or private-type constructions are exempt also.
So from my standpoint, I guess asked and answered, and it is codified is the real answer. It's codified that it's allowed.
Right.
Okay.
And then just on that, the letter you referenced also, I think their fear was that they have some, they're next to these wetlands also, these very wetlands. And their fear is like, oh, city's going to write themselves out of it and then not come back and deal with the issues we have by being adjacent to kind of crummy wetlands, using a professional biological term. What we've talked to Greg Reardon and his attorneys about over time, as we come back in and amend our sensitive area regulations as a whole, which is required by the state starting next year, the King County has a system in place called mitigation banking, where if you have a substandard wetland like this, rather than save all of the poor, low-functioning wetlands, you can bank those, pay into a fund that builds high-quality wetlands someplace else. Mm-hmm. And so I think their fear, for some reason, I talked to them after the Planning Commission hearing, was that we weren't going to come back and amend our ordinance. But state law says we're due to come back in and amend our ordinance.
Well, I had this mark on the letter. I'll bring it up now because it's exactly that. I think the second thing besides the banking is that oftentimes when you piecemeal a sensitive area, the people who piecemeal at first exacerbate the problem on adjacent areas that make it more difficult to resolve through mitigation and compound their areas when they land bank.
Right.
Or when they wetland bank or sensitive area bank, when they bank it. And so how is that going to be addressed? Because if I was a property owner, I would be freaked out about that.
you have to address that. So this, there's water there to deal with. You can't just, it's like jumping in the bathtub. You have to address this, the capacity issue of the hydrology in that area. So it's not just a matter of filling wetlands and like you squirt that water onto your neighbor's property and now you've solved your problem. You really have to, as part of the mitigation banking, you have to address the hydrology through
conveyance. Well, so, but how is that addressed when you simply go and maintain the corridor and top coat it with gravel?
Oh, I don't think I was tracking the question.
Yeah, if you're going to simply go in and maintain the road and usurp the sensitive area rules by going onto the trail and doing something, the fines could change water movements and squirt water. How do you deal if you're going to not follow the, if it's okay to just not follow the rules and top coat the trail, that may affect other people's property, because this is a dividing line. It
right.
You know, it's built on a bank, so right. It's going to squirt water one way or the other if fines get down and change water paths.
Right. You still have to, the city or anybody still has to deal with that through the surface water regulations. In the code, there's requirements for mitigation of any identified impacts with it. So it's not just ignoring it. It's not filling any new wetland areas. I'm talking about the cities. When I was talking about filling or mitigation banking, I was talking about the private development. The city isn't proposing to fill any wetlands. So it's a matter of mitigating any impacts you have and addressing any surface water impacts you have with the construction.
Okay. Let me move on. So now I'm on page 15 of our packet. Item number 2B, it says the planning official may allow a required yard to be reduced to 0 feet for one story. My only question on that was, we heard a presentation about the multiple use of the trail for the coming bullet train. And is 0 feet, it still works for that, and that 0 foot it still would work with any sort of rail corridor.
Right.
That was my question.
I mean, it would take, if the
it works for a train
high
now,
capacity,
I guess, so.
Transit needed additional right of way, the onus is on them to acquire that right of way.
Okay. The rail that David Godfrey talked about, and he talked about that the current trail path was being designed to allow for a future rail transit system. So the 0 foot setback still works with all the regulations for a future rail, should that happen.
It does. I mean, you could certainly picture a scenario where you have a restaurant deck right up against what's now high capacity transit as opposed to a nice bicycle trail. So it's a different relationship.
Okay. On that same page, let me figure out why I asked this question. So I wrote this down twice. I'm on number 3, the last sentence on page 15. It talks about the planning official or design review board may waive compliance to a particular regulation an applicant demonstrates is not feasible. Here, and I'll point it out in another place on page 16, item 3, second sentence. In those two cases, the word waive is written. And I just might suggest that the word waive be changed to modify. Because waive, from a legal standpoint, indicates a complete erasing of something, as opposed to modifying or manipulating to better fit the situation. And I think that's what the intent of this regulation is to work with the spirit of the conditions to make the situation work, not simply erase a condition. So I think the word waive ought to be changed. On page 16, the very first letter I, this is where we're talking about the landscape strips. I'll wait for you to catch up, Jeremy.
All right, I'm with you. Go ahead.
We talked about the landscape strips and my recommendation about grouping and that sort of thing. I understand the Planning Commission's comment, have no issues at all. However, this letter I talks about, we state no more than 8 contiguous parking stalls. I understood you in our last meeting to, and I'm ignorant of this, but I understood you in our last meeting to mention that there are some conditions now, there's language in the Kirkland Code that allows people to manipulate parking areas so the strict 8 contiguous cars, then a parking island, 8 cars, can be somehow modified. And I read this and I thought, well, this does not allow for any manipulation in that to work around existing trees, topography, that sort of thing. So help enlighten me here. What did I miss something in that last meeting?
No, there is, in the old days, it used to say 8, you go 8 stalls and have a landscape island, 8 stalls and have a landscape island. Since that time, the regulations have been loosened up to say you don't have to be so literal about that 8 landscape island, 8 landscape island. Take that area and arrange it however you see fit in the parking lot itself. So this is saying, no, we really want that landscaping adjoining the corridor. Having it on the other side of the site or elsewhere on the site isn't as important as actually having those breaks in the parking lots where they adjoin the corridor. So this is going back to being much more specific about the requirement of where the landscaping goes.
So you purposefully did this?
Yes.
Got it. And the idea of discussing some other flexible way of that based on the Planning Commission's recommendation, the can got kicked down the road.
Right.
Okay, so I shan't bring that up anymore. I want to mention, same page, 16B, Roman numeral 4. I want to applaud the term. You say, shall not exceed 120 feet without vertical definition. That term, vertical definition, I think in an architectural language where architects read code, is extremely good. And I know in the past we have discussed how do we define articulating modulation. This, I think, is very good. So, just a attaboy. Page 17, item number 4, talks about modifications of existing facilities, etc. And in reading a couple of the letters, especially the one from, Bob John's office, the legal firm letter, they make the point that when people come to a car dealership, they really normally, not always, but normally don't show up on bicycles or walk. They drive in their car. So that got me thinking about land planning of existing buildings and landowners that have existing facilities that don't meet this 10-foot setback. And I didn't understand from our previous meeting, and so therefore don't really understand, existing buildings that are built within the proposed 10-foot setback along the corridor, what sort of modifications will be allowed and thresholds implemented where they would have to remove that, you know, existing non-conforming condition, and how does the legal existing non-conforming conditions work with the violation of the proposed 10-foot setback?
Same as any other setback in the code, in that if you have a legally established non-conformance, it can continue in perpetuity. You're limited in that you can't make structural alterations or additions in that non-conforming area. And if you redevelop the site, then that 10-foot setback is going to be brought into conformance.
Perfect.
So they're basically godfathered in. That's not right. But they're like the rest of the buildings in town that have been built before the new codes were put in.
The next item that I had was on the letter that we got from the people that own the winery, Scott and Michelle Holm. And that's on page 37 of our packet, paragraph block number 1. They talk about a non-recognized zone, and item number 3 talks about their licensing requirements and that sort of thing. This really made an awful lot of sense to me. And is there anything in our packet tonight, because I didn't really see it, but is there anything in the proposed language that fixes this issue that would allow this?
Yes, nothing in Houghton
Understand.
Jurisdiction.
But Understand.
In the Totem Lake zones, ELIT, Planned Area 6G, those kind of older warehousey type zones, breweries and wineries, distilleries are all allowed as manufacturing uses in Kirkland. But we thought this made a lot of sense also to just break it out and make it clear that they can do business in these areas. And then with that, there was confusion on the Planning Commission as to what about tasting rooms, because sometimes we call them restaurants, sometimes we call them accessory retail sales. So when we broke out wineries, breweries, distilleries, then we came up with specific tasting room regulations for those new use listings.
Okay. On that, I don't see 6. I know it's up in Totem Lake, but on the map, I don't see PLA 6G represented on that.
And there may be there was a bad map floating around that got in one of the packets, maybe in yours, but it's essentially the Google Phase 2 area. So you won't see a winery, brewery, or distillery there, but it's over on the opposite, the current Google campus, it's opposite the corridor from that.
Okay. Thought you said in your memo that tasting rooms for breweries in the PLA 6G zones should be allowed.
And they are.
They are.
It's just a, well, not that you can see this well either, but this is the Google campus in an LIT zone. This map, for some reason, didn't pick up that planned area 6G zone, which
is
just
that's what mine shows. So that's 6G there. Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
And so the again on the letter that Holmes wrote, a correct definition has been created: manufacturing, tasting. So it does work.
Yep.
Okay. That's all I had.
Anyone else have any questions or comments?
Just have one little itty bitty.
Okay.
On page 17. Number 5, second line in the red.
After to the extent feasible.
After number 1, the trail is located in a manner that extent feasible. I think you meant that to the extent feasible. I'm guessing. Anyway.
Or an 80s way to
emphasize it.
It's on page 17, 90.20, paragraph 5, right. Second line.
Provided, comma, that when the trail is located in a manner that to
the extent
feasible avoids and minimizes impacts.
Isn't that a double emphasis? The?
That's what I said.
Yeah.
No. I don't think that's what was meant.
Wasn't intentional.
I didn't think so.
That's the kind of thing that...
It's easy just to sort of read through it and you know what it says. So I just thought I'd point that out.
Bill, did you have something?
Yeah, Jeremy, do you have any latest intel on whether Bellevue is going to be doing anything or to the north, Bothell?
No. Woodinville,
Woodinville will be
2 weeks ago, decided to acquire their segment. Bothell or Bellevue, I haven't heard.
So Bellevue hasn't even acquired their segment?
No.
So it's still owned by Burlington Northern?
I'm not sure if it would be Burlington Northern or King County.
Oh, okay.
I think King County's plan was to pick up the rest of it.
Anything
One more
else?
Thing that's somewhat off the topic, but it is somewhat related to the corridor, so I'll just bring it up again. I think a couple of us have asked a couple of times, and I know this is not your department, and I don't expect it tonight, but I really hope that we will have soon on another agenda an update of what's happening with the TOD and, you know, plan completion, what's the stage of the project. I get questions from neighbors all the time about, you know, what's going in down there, when's it going to be available, what's going to be done, and it would just be really great to have some updated information on that.
Okay.
Yeah, well, let's
on the agenda.
Let's finish it, yeah.
Yes, in the future.
Anything
not right
else
now. Not
right on now. The tour, the corridor? I would, as long as we're making notes, that on the first page you show our meeting on March 24th, 2013. Actually, I think it was 2014, for what it's worth. It doesn't really affect anything other than accuracy.
Later down the line, will there be meetings for discussion about what the different amenities will be, you know, the bathrooms and benches and things like that that people want? Will they have some input as to what happens?
There has been an ongoing process. I think for over a year now, the master planning process has had a lot of public meetings. I think a draft of it, I was just reading it in the back while PSC was presenting. I think there's a draft that will go to City Council in May. I think the second meeting in May, they'll see a draft of the master plan. So it's getting close to kind of having the overall framework laid out. And I think adoption scheduled for June.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, and for the record, there are no audience members present for us to have a public hearing, so we will dispense with that. And with that, we are asked to, I guess, make a recommendation on the amendments. And I think the City Council is going to be voting on this on May 6th, right?
Correct.
So, would anyone care to, John? You've had the most issues. I know that you specifically wanted to see a modification of that one term on page 15.
Yeah, it was
the modify versus waive.
15 and 16. Yeah.
Why don't you suggest what you would like to recommend? And then we can go from there.
So this would be the file number CAM-14. Jeremy, is that correct?
Correct.
I'd like to move that the Houghton Community Council approve file number CAM-14-00269 as presented, with the exception on page 15, Item 3, the word waived, and 16, Roman numeral 3, the word waived, be changed to the word modified.
Okay.
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion?
That's the only change?
That's all of John's suggesting to modify.
I think everything else was asked and answered.
Any discussion? Any discussion? All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Okay, thank you.
So,
Rick, can I make a comment about something?
Well, yeah.
I'm mighty glad that we are not responsible for this, but the condos down at the bottom of 108, where all their trees and everything are gone, and now they're, it has nothing to do with this, thank heaven. They're looking right straight out into the cars and everything is there. One of those women approached me, and she says, we've just lost $5,000 off of our property value.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I'm really sorry, but this is Bellevue, and I don't have anything to do with it. So,
well, I certainly hope that when the mitigation comes back and the plantings happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible. I feel sorry
fixed,
for
yeah.
What are they doing down there?
It's the 520 expansion project, yeah. Now, I would, for future, I'd like to see, this would be appropriate topic for the council member comments and
really?
Well, yeah, I mean, rather than bringing it up, I don't want to have just this loose stretch. Anytime you feel like asking something, you bring it up. So not, I don't want to be overly formal, but I'd like to keep it within some sort of a structure. Any administrative reports?
Only that your next meeting is May 22nd.
Yep.
Everybody got that?
Yep.
Thursday night.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay.
And if I could quickly, Jeremy, I want to applaud you on the way that this package was put together. Oftentimes the way they go through the different groups of people and they're added to, it's very difficult to say what's added, what's changed, whatever. This was straightforward in that manner. The way that you put the little red dots in here and the verbiage that says applicable, not applicable, to help guide us through this was extremely simple and made this really easy. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeremy. Meeting adjourned.